from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may remember a few years ago, I asked the question, why does the flu get worse in the wintertime? Why does the flu predominate in wintertime? Had a lot of answers, none of them really convincing. Until this week, when Gina Colata, do you like Gina Colata? In the New York Times, came up with a report on research being done in New York. New York, I know. But still, the answer, they report, has to do with the virus itself, the flu virus. It's more stable and stays in the air longer when the air is cold and dry. It's more likely to be transmitted during winter on the way to the subway than in a warm room, says Peter Palese, a flu researcher at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Good reason to be in your own car then, huh? Screw that rapid transit. Dr. Palese published details of his findings last month. The crucial hint that allowed him to do his study came from a paper published in the aftermath of the 1918 flu pandemic, when doctors were puzzling over why it had spread so quickly and been so deadly. As long as flu has been recognized, Gina Colata writes. Do you like Gina Colata? People have asked, why winter? Oh, so I wasn't the first. Okay. The very name. Influenza is an Italian word that some historians say originated in the 19th century as influenza di freddo, or influenza of the cold. In the tropics, there's not much flu at all and no real flu season. Anyway, apparently that's this week's version of the story. There is one correction worth noting in the media. It is a Los Angeles dog trainer correction, of course. An article in last Sunday's calendar section about actor James McAvoy said he received an Oscar nomination this year for The Last King of Scotland. He was not nominated. Well, it's almost an honor to be not nominated. Speaking of which, thanks to the Academy for my Grammy nomination. Now maybe you'll buy it now. Now, see, it's Grammy nominated. Now it makes a really good Christmas gift. And ladies and gentlemen, not talked about much on this broadcast, basically because it's relatively confusing, is the subprime mortgage mess that has resulted in a credit crisis around the world, like as Wolf Blitzer likes to say. It's reached Australia. It's reaching the United Kingdom. Hasn't reached the non-English-speaking countries, which is interesting. And it all started with these newfangled mortgages being given to people who could never qualify for mortgages before because they got rid of the qualifications. That was the new thing. That was the innovation. These qualifications, we don't need these. And the way they defended that was that they sliced and diced up the loans and then resold them as part of a package of securities. They're so-called because they're so insecure. And so they spread the risk around the world, and now as these mortgage holders go into default, banks far afield are writing off billions of dollars in bad loans that in many cases they didn't even know they had. Or in many cases the guys who ran the company while they got the bad loans, like the head of Merrill Lynch, walked away with a $50 million golden handshake after leaving the company to write off, you know, billions of dollars in bad loans. But that's business. Anyway, there's a lot of blame to go around. I personally think it all started when they started to call loans products. Financial services companies, despite their name, began to describe what they did for a living as products. Now, you know, there's something real about the idea that a loan is a service. If I lend you money, I've done you a service. I haven't given you a product. But they started calling these things products. And then, you know, what do you do when you make products? You figure out new products. You don't figure out new services. I don't know if you do. But we were warned, ladies and gentlemen, lest you think we weren't warned. This is from dug up by the Australian newspaper, The Age. In April 2005, Alan Greenspan, the great Eminence Grise of the Federal Reserve, was speaking to Fed employees working in the field of community engagement. Quote, innovation has brought about a multitude of new products, such as subprime loans. Where once more marginal applicants would simply have been denied credit, lenders are now able to quite efficiently judge the risk posed by individual applicants and to price that risk accordingly. These improvements have led to rapid growth in subprime mortgage lending, fostering constructive innovation that is both responsive to market demand and beneficial to consumers, unquote. The warning from Alan Greenspan in 2005.
Well, it's
kind of a warning. Hello, welcome to the show. From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now it's an epidemic of tales of airport security. Maybe because it's holiday season. Maybe it's the time of year. Maybe it's the time of man. And his woman. We got a couple. Oh, that's an epidemic. Grant writes, I had a bit of an adventure a few weeks ago in Atlanta. On the return engagement of a trip to Atlanta from San Diego, I noticed that my driver's license, the only official form of ID I was carrying, was missing. We went to the Delta counter and explained my predicament to the attendant. She told me I would not be able to fly. I told her I couldn't believe I was the only person since 9/11 to have their ID go missing en route. I showed her my ticket stub for the incoming segment, but she was not impressed. I was able to get her supervisor involved, and it soon came to light that there is no ID requirement to be issued a boarding pass. It's only a courtesy to help reduce problems downstream with the TSA. I was told that I would need to go to the business office and get an affidavit from someone who could swear to me being me at the cost of around $50. I'll do it for $25, babe. On the way to the office, I asked directions from a TSA agent directing people to the gate. I mentioned my predicament and asked if there was anything I could do to expedite the matter through security. He told me there was no need for the affidavit, that all the booking agent has to do is stamp the boarding pass with a secondary inspection stamp. Back I went to the counter. The agent was at first unwilling to provide this service, but after an okay from her supervisor, I was on my way. I prepared myself for the worst, expecting to be strip-searched and interrogated in a dimly lit room by grim-faced TSA investigators as water dripped in the background, but no such horror. They swabbed my bag for explosives, and that was it. It turns out I had dropped my ID at the San Diego checkpoint and was able to recover it when I got back home. This one from Sarah. My Indian, I believe that's Dot, not Feather, sister-in-law's sister, just died, and to help ease the pain, she invited her father to travel from India to share Thanksgiving together. This meaningful event was forestalled by airport security, who barred the elderly gentleman and his cane from the plane because he did not have a transit visa. Evidently, because his flight made two connections in Europe, he was required to obtain a visa. Had there been but a single connection, this would not have been necessary. But because this 90-pound octogenarian was afforded the possibility of ditching his itinerary twice, the visa was a necessary security blanket. The gentleman was never advised of this requirement either by the travel agent or the airline before purchasing the ticket. So he was turned away at the airport and failed to make it for Thanksgiving. Although I'm not positive about this, I believe he was assessed a penalty for having to re-ticket. Sarah concludes, I feel safer. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news from outside the bubble. It's wall-to-wall copyrighted features this week, isn't it? In the past 5 months, more than 40 women have been murdered and their bodies dumped in the street by militiamen in Basra. The British Army is formally to hand Basra over to Iraqi control in less than 2 weeks, claiming it had done all it could to stabilize the southern port city. But Britain appears to be leaving Basra ever more firmly in the hands of lawless gangs and strict morality police. Messages are scrawled in graffiti, warning women not to venture out without observing Islamic dress codes. Quote, whoever disobeys will be punished. God is our witness, says one scrawled in red paint on a wall. A huge advertisement for mobile phones featuring a mother and child has been defaced to blot out the uncovered woman's head with the slogan, no, no to unveiled women. At a university in Basra, Sunni students complained of being harassed by Shia militias. A 19-year-old Sunni freshman was told he had to grow a beard, but keep his hair short. He said that boys and girls who try to sit next to each other will be told to stay apart and given a lecture on Islamic virtue. Self-appointed morality police also grab people's cell phones and scroll through them looking for immoral video clips, music, or pictures, according to the same student. Despite Basra's increasing similarity to the repressive Iranian theocracy, which many believe has exerted influence over the city, Britain says its work in Basra is done. Meanwhile, two possibly conflicting stories about that other war in Afghanistan and on drugs. From The Guardian, the U.S. government has conceded defeat in its attempt to persuade the Afghanistan government to begin aerial destruction of poppy fields as part of its opium eradication strategy. We have decided to stop pursuing the aerial spraying of poppy fields in Afghanistan, says Thomas Schweich from the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. U.S. officials have climbed down in the face of widespread criticism from the Afghan government and other coalition partners, including our pals in Britain. What? Are they pro-poppy? Well, they wear them, you know, once a year on Veterans Day, but it's a different poppy. Although attempting to destroy poppy crops from the ground can be dangerous, the Afghan government is against the aerial spraying because of fears about the herbicide glyphosate's effect on the environment, other crops, and people's health. That's how primitive they are. Get with it. The United States has always indicated we would not pursue any counter-narcotics activity in Afghanistan that would not have the full support of the government of Afghanistan, says the State Department. Schweich is now touring Europe, a good soldier, to explain the change in policy and to drum up support for other counter-narcotics initiatives. What, spraying them from underground? No, ground-based eradication will continue. But the decision on whether to proceed with ground-based spraying is still under discussion with the Afghan government. On the other hand, this from the Times of London today. Where opium poppies used to color the plains of northern Afghanistan, towering marijuana plants now sway in the wind. Farmers in Balkh province were banned from cultivating opium last year and have switched to another cash crop, a rich source of income that is tolerated by the authorities. Balkh's burgeoning hashish industry does not pay farmers quite as much as the heroin factories used to for good quality opium, but the rich black cannabis resin produced around the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif still pays about four times the price of cotton or wheat, which would answer that question. It's highly prized by Afghan users. They get all the hash. Oh, and is exported in large quantities to Pakistan, our ally, and Europe. The opium clampdown has transformed a minor cash crop into big business. It's a 40% rise in marijuana production or hashish production this year in Afghanistan. The switch is the latest embarrassment to Western attempts at eradication. It also illustrates the desperation of poor farmers. Afghanistan already produces 93% of the world's opium, which must tick off the Burmese. Didn't they used to do that? Wasn't that triangle? It was down there. Farmers were busily harvesting their marijuana plants this week. Roadside stores keep hashish hidden among the onions and biscuits. So in case you have an onion and a sudden desire for hashish hits you, it's right there. Hashish, says one shopkeeper, with a lazy smile, according to the Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch. Hashish is good business. Unlike opium, cannabis, hashish is smoked by some farmers without serious social consequences. The only thing is there seem to be more layabouts now that we grow so much cannabis, one said. Government has stopped us from growing opium, says one farmer, so what can we do? We're saving up for a Toyota Corolla. It is one world. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. An interesting story on nuclear waste. A couple of them, actually, this week. One is that the Department of Energy has been fined $500,000 by the state of Washington for a hazardous radioactive spill at the Hanford nuclear site. Most contaminated nuclear site in the world, or at least in this country. The spill occurred last July when workers were pumping waste from an underground tank. They tried to unblock a pump by running it in reverse, but 85 gallons of waste spilled onto the ground. Quote, before the spill was discovered, a series of poor decisions put workers in grave danger from exposure to the tank waste and vapors, said the manager of Washington State's Department of Ecology's nuclear waste program. 63 workers were identified for ongoing medical monitoring. 13 have already complained of symptoms. Removing waste from aging tanks is one of the Energy Department's highest priorities at Hanford. So you got to make mistakes. I didn't say that. And here's a little thing that just became known this week. The U.S. may be storing a large amount of French nuclear waste. Why didn't we hear about this when it was all the French bashing at the beginning of the war? That would have been good. That would have been a good contributor. French nuclear waste, which we now call freedom waste. This was suggested in a keynote address at a conference in San Francisco by Dr. Yogi Goswami, former president of the International Solar Energy Society. He says a large majority from the nuclear waste from France is actually shipped to the United States, stored in South Carolina. Because when initially the French started building nuclear reactors, the U.S. was suspicious of the French. Yeah, how time has flown. There's a contractual relationship that all of the waste comes to the U.S. and is stored in Savannah River Laboratory, which is a U.S. Department of Energy lab for nuclear waste. Well, there can't be any mistakes made there. It's run by the Department of Energy. News of Inspectors General, putting my plural where it belongs. Howard Cookie Krongard, the embattled Inspector General of the State Department, announced this week he's stepping down, ending his turbulent tenure. He came under fire from employees and lawmakers, accused he was of impeding key investigations related to Iraq, including one looking into Blackwater, because his brother, it turns out, he didn't know this, it turns out, was on the board, advisory board, Blackwater. He is staying until January 15th to complete a project he calls his impossible dream, the establishment of a Middle East branch of the Inspector General's office. In Baghdad? No, in Amman. He wouldn't want to put it in Baghdad. And federal officials say they will investigate why a $1 billion insurance fund created by Congress to cover claims of sick Ground Zero workers after 9/11 is fighting the cases in court rather than paying out the claims. I'll tell you why, because they're acting like an insurance company. News of the inspectors general, ladies and gentlemen. It's not copyrighted. Maybe someday it will be. Maybe when the lawyers have nothing else to do. And wouldn't talk about an impossible dream. This is Le Show. Coming up, Dick Cheney casts aspersions at the size of the members' members. But you know that a couple of big blockbuster stories this week had to do with Intel. Not the company, the thing. First of all, the head of the National, now I'm so confused about who's the director of national intelligence, who's the director of central intelligence. I don't think Negroponte stood up and presented this, but anyway, the intelligence community, and what a wonderful community it is. Love to go to their picnics, wouldn't you? They released a new national intelligence estimate this week, made it public, the declassified version of it, supposedly put together in a hurry last weekend when it became obvious it was going to leak. And as you all know by now, it says, of course Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. And the most stunning thing to me was the frequency of the use of the word stunning to describe that report by news media that, once again, haven't been paying attention to anything except what comes out of Washington and maybe New York. Because there was Mohammed El-Baradei of the IAEA, just like he did before the Iraq war, saying, no, it's not what they say. And yet, and you know, the interesting thing is certain people seem to just get a pass. Like John Bolton goes on the air and says, no, we still have reason to consider attacking Iran because they haven't come clean in all the ways that's required by the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which they're a signatory. And nobody brings up the fact that for most of his tenure in the Bush administration, John Bolton was saying it's perfectly okay for the United States to ignore provisions of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty with which we don't happen to agree at the moment. It's, you know, he's got a book to promote. Anyway, then later in the week, when questioned about the new national intelligence estimate that Iran doesn't have a nuclear program, shut it down in 2003. Dana Perino, the White House spokeswoman, said, well, President Bush really didn't know about this till last week. So when he said World War III in October, he wasn't. And then at the end of the week, the CIA revealed in advance of a New York Times revealing that it had destroyed tapes of a couple of interrogation sessions at which reportedly waterboarding, you know, that non-torture, was practiced way back in 2005. And in case you wonder why Americans don't trust Congress, there were 2 days of members of Congress stepping in front of every available microphone and camera to say, oh, I am so outraged. Why, we didn't know, and we would never have, and this is so, and why didn't they tell, and why didn't they ask us? And then Sunday's Washington Post reveals that the CIA did brief the heads of the intelligence committees on these interrogations, and I believe on the taping of them. And officials who were at the briefing said nobody asked any questions. Nobody asked if they were waterboarding. In fact, the whole demeanor was, go, team. You sure you're doing it rough enough? And in the wake of this revelation, Dana Perino, the White House press spokesman, once again had to come out and say, the president didn't know anything about this. I thought the reason you run for that office is so you could know everything that's going on, at least in your government, if not in Iran, let's say. It might be a cause, as a matter of fact, for a certain phone call next here on the show.
Hello. Hey, 41. Anytime you want to call off your rot burgers, it's okay with me. 43, just thinking about you. Of course, I'm at Rot Boilers. Mitt Romney said the nicest thing the other night, said he hoped his wife would look as presidential as Laura. Yeah, first lady wife. You know, 41, all the small talk in the world is not going to keep me from getting to the point of this call. Listen. No, you're calling to brag about the surge, and of course, it's always good news when there's less violence.
Yeah.
Less, of course, it's our violence, and we're trying to prevent greater possible violence, you know, just trying to be fair.
Yeah. But look, don't get me wrong. I'm very proud of General Petraeus, and I'm fond of the guy. Knows a ridiculous amount of stuff about the American League. But my dear father figure, I'm suggesting that your friends over at the CIA have done just about enough to try to sabotage my achievements. I think it's really about time you call in your chips with your old pals over there while they're still over there.
Sprout, this is something we talked about back in 2003.
I know it.
Warned you that the company wasn't going to take being the fall guy sitting down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never could quite figure out that warning.
Told you a couple of years ago they'd take a bullet for you on Iraqi intel, but they wouldn't take an entire clip of bullets.
Yeah, that was a little clearer.
Just know that place a little bit. Always thought there was just so far you could push them before they start pushing back.
Look, I could understand being sidewinded by that new NIE. I mean, I keep telling Dick Cheney, you know, let me know earlier next time. And sometimes I think that fella keeps his cards so close to his vest, he can't even read them.
You got to give CIA credit for playing a news cycle like a Stradivarius on the new estimate.
I never saw him play, so I wouldn't know. Yeah. But man, destroying the tapes of the extremely robust interrogation practices.
Extremely robust.
Yeah, the changester's word or words. But I mean, yeah, destroying those tapes and leaking that to their pals at the New York Times. That's damn close to treasonesque behavior.
Probably kind of subtle pushback for outing one of their agents and leaking it to Dick's pals at every paper in town.
See, maybe we just have a different view of the function of leadership and of followership.
Yeah.
Every effective leader knows how important it is to share credit and to send it down the ladder.
Sure.
But it's only the leader who understands how to preserve his power, who knows how to send blame down the ladder, too.
Is this some of your business school stuff?
My evoluting of it? So for me to be able to keep my stroke, as some might put it, is sometimes necessary for people at CIA or elsewhere to shoulder some or more of the responsibility for some decisions maybe they didn't make. Too bad. You know, this petty retaliating doesn't help anyone. It's lose-lose.
I think from the agency's point of view, it puts the planets back in their proper orbits. Kind of win-lose, maybe even if you learn from it, win-win.
See, if I was trying to be optimistic, like Karl Rove used to tell people I was, I'd say maybe win-win-lose, or win-lose-lose, but
frankly, you just gotta hope that the two shoes that dropped this week were all the shoes are gonna drop.
Well, I'd have to grow more feet.
Yeah, I guess they would.
Hey, but you know, there's something a little bit disturbing about people over there putting themselves in the position to make certain national security decisions that, according to the Constitution, I'm supposed to let Dick Cheney make. What lesson do you think President Ahmadinejad going to take away from this little epicenter?
Probably take away the lesson that you don't mess with CIA. Not a bad lesson. But surely the company briefed somebody over there about the tapes.
Yeah, they briefed somebody over here, but they know as well as I do that I'm compartmentalized for my own deniability. It's their job to counter-compartmentalize me on something this important. I mean, I got everybody in Congress thinking that we were waterboarding these people.
Well, you were.
Just saying, that's the kind of thing that they should know how to stovepipe up to me. I mean, 41, it boils down to this. If I can't trust my own spies, who am I supposed to trust?
Yeah, I guess it does boil down to that.
Yeah.
Look, 43, not really wired into the new people. Know them just by reputation and secret dossier, but really don't think they want an ongoing war with you. Besides, you don't have too many other initiatives available for them to torpedo at this point.
No, that's true.
Well, there you go. Where's the challenge for them in that?
Yeah.
So, look, congratulations on the surge. And tell Laura I said so as well.
Will do.
We good?
Yeah, we're good. You take care, 41.
You too, Sprout.
There are many, many crazy things that will keep me loving you.
Ladies and gentlemen, news from over there. First of all,